On this episode of ID the Future, listen to a lecture given by David Snoke at a conference sponsored by the Christian Scientific Society, hosted by Discovery Institute in November 2015. Dr. Snoke, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Pittsburgh, discusses the Maxwell's Demon Thought Experiment and evaluates the odds of an information processing system occurring spontaneously.
Okay, so I'm going to finish up with an extended discussion of Maxwell's Demon. This is my favorite Maxwell's Demon from the web here. This is the canonical example that lots and lots of people have written on, the example of Maxwell's Demon. So hopefully this will bring into focus a lot of the stuff I've been talking about. So the picture here you imagine is you've got a gas in a box, a bunch of atoms bouncing around in the box. You've got a partition with a hole in it, and then you've got a slider, which the demon, whatever that may be, can control. And so this is actually come up with by James Maxwell, the famous Maxwell of thermodynamics and electrodynamics. And so you can say, well, let's assume that the energy cost of the sliding door is negligible. That's not too hard to imagine, because you can say, look, it can be very lubricated, so there's almost no friction and so on. Let's also assume the cost of observing the particles is negligible, so you can look in. And there have been some people who've tried to address this with saying, well, if it's quantum mechanical, you have to bounce photons off them and so on. But actually, that turns out to be not relevant. So we can really pretty legitimately assume that both of these are negligible costs. And so the experiment then is you say, well, this little demon is going to slide the door in and out. And so whenever there's a particle going from the right to the left, he lets it go through. And whenever there's one coming from the left to the right, he closes the door so it bounces off. And so after a while, he's sorted them so that most of them are on one side and very few are on the other side. So he's created a pressure difference where there's high pressure here and low pressure here. And so if I was just looking at the gas, I would say the total entropy of the system has decreased. It's gone into a more ordered state. It's less disordered. And he could sort it other ways, right? He could make it hot on one side and cold on the other by letting fast particles go to one side and slow particles go to the other side, and so on and so forth. So as he sorts these things, then you could actually then say, well, now he can actually use that for useful work. So he could say, all right, now that I've got all the fast ones on this side, I'm going to disconnect this partition and let the pressure on this push the wall in this direction. Okay? And I could have some kind of crankshaft attached to that that would actually spin, and I would get usable work from pushing that partition on one side. Okay? Then I lock it down. I say, okay, now let me sort them the other way. So now I resort them, waiting for them all to get one this side, right? And then use them to push it, the partition, back the other way. Right? And so I could have a little machine in which, just by sorting, I'm generating usable energy that can be used by the outside world to drive something. And so in this case, and this is, you know, what many people have thought about for many years, information has essentially been turned into energy, right? Because if we say there's essentially zero energy cost for moving the door or for observing the particles, then all the demon had was information, and yet he was able to extract energy from the system and use that to drive something. Okay, so again, there's fungibility between information and energy, which should make you think information is a real thing. It's not just an imaginary construct. Now, it's not just a thought experiment, because, you know, we may not have demons, but we have people. Okay? And so I could actually do this experiment. So we could go to outer space on a space shuttle. I could make a big bay. I could fill it with bowling balls floating in zero gravity that bounce off the walls, and then I could literally, you know, move a door to let them sort them that way. Okay, so there's nothing particularly microscopic that needs to be going on in Maxwell's Demon, right? So we could do this because we know that we are able to do what the demon does. And as a matter of fact, there's lots of video games that you get to play Maxwell's Demon and open the door and close it and so on. All right, so in some ways, Maxwell's Demon is really a surrogate for thinking about life, because we know, sort of what Casey was saying, we know we exist, we know we can do this, and so what do we conclude about Maxwell's Demon then? Well, not only that, but we could build a computer to do the same thing, right? So I could take the computer that I've built, so it's associated with human life because I built it, but I could have it then, you know, move the door and do the same sorting process and so on. So we could also translate it that way. So these are all real experiments that can be done. So one of the things we can ask is, does the existence of a Maxwell's Demon violate the second law of thermodynamics? We've converted information into usable energy. Well, one way to cast that is to say, could we make a perpetual motion machine? So for instance, I could say, heat flows in from the walls, keeping these things at constant temperature. Okay, then the demon sorts the particles on one side or the other, uses that to push the wall back and forth. Then we use that to drive a little engine, and then we use that to power the computer. Okay, and so if we can sustain this, that would be a perpetual motion machine, right? Where I just have conversion of ambient temperature into usable work, and that would violate the second law of thermodynamics. So what breaks down? And a lot of people for a lot of decades have thought about this. And essentially, you can show that writing information has to require some work. And one way to think about this is imagine that we've got some kind of hill. So we're going to store information by having a particle on one side of the hill or on the other side of the hill. So this will be bit zero and this will be value one. And so if I want this to be a good memory storage, this barrier has to be larger than the average fluctuation in energy due to the temperature, right? Which is of order KT, where T is the temperature. So if it's very hot, it's just going to fly up and go over this and I'll lose my memory. So I have to have this barrier be larger than KT so this thing stays well-defined inside this local minimum here. Now, if I want to rewrite it, then I have to get it to jump over the barrier. So suppose I say it's here in state one, and I want to do a reset. I want to set all my memory to the zero state. I have to put energy in to move it over this barrier, and then it's going to have to fall down and dissipate that energy to the environment. And so it's going to lose, for one bit of information, it's going to lose KT of information to the environment. And so there's always an energy cost for cooling down this particle, which is what's necessary in storing memory in the first place. On the other hand, how much energy can I get out using information? Well, this is sometimes called the Szilagyi engine. So you can imagine the sort of minimal possible Maxwell's Demon experiment. Okay, we just got one atom in here, okay? And so now we're going to say, I've got this wall as a slider here. So if the particle is on the right side over here, I'm going to pin down the wall, okay, and it's just bounce around in there. But if the particle is over on the other side, I'm going to let this particle bounce on the wall, exert a force on it, and move the wall, which I then use to extract energy. Okay? And so that way I could keep this wall moving by just waiting for the ball to come back around and push it a little bit more again. All right? And so the amount of energy per collision is KT, which, you know, again, the average kinetic energy of this thing. So the amount I can extract in moving the wall is the amount of the average energy of this particle, which is KT. All right, and so that's how much I can extract. So we've got a cost for information writing, and we've got an amount that we're getting. Basically, we can't win, right? Because if the computer and the gas are at the same temperature, and that's a big caveat here, if they're at the same temperature, the demon will break down. Okay, the demon will have to spend more energy writing than it gains from moving the wall to run the electric generator. Okay, and so second law of thermodynamics is preserved. Okay, so in general, the existence of the human does not violate the second law of thermodynamics, at least in its operation. But in the example I talked about in outer space, if I put a human in outer space, I could sort those things for a long time, and I could get a lot of free energy out of that system by sorting. And one way to think about it is to say that actually, in the example of the human in outer space with the billiard balls or the bowling balls, those balls actually are effectively at much hotter temperature than the person is. You can just do that. Average KT is 1/2 mv squared. If m is large, then it's going to be a huge KT. And so it's going to be much, much larger than what's necessary for the human to do any kind of mental writing. And so basically, in our example, the human or the demon was small compared to the particles. And so the effective temperature of the gas was much harder than the demon. Another way to put that is it started out in a low entropy state. I had distinct hot and cold regions. So the fact that the demon was in such a low temperature compared to the system was sorting already means that we had low entropy. So essentially, what we say is the operation of the demon does not violate the second law. It won't work forever. It's not a perpetual motion machine. Okay, it can't use the energy to run it. But does the existence of the demon? That's a little bit of a deeper question. So some people, I think in the literature, I think people have not paid attention too much to the temperature of the demon not necessarily being the same as the temperature of the system. They always tend to assume they're at the same temperature. But like if a human is at the temperature of the system, when you reach room temperature, you're in bad shape, right? So humans are oftentimes at very different temperatures from the systems that they're studying. So I think it's not an intrinsic thing. And I think more generally, I could make a system in which a small demon, a human, was in sorting a large system and was able to sort those particles for a very, very long time at fairly negligible energy costs. And so eventually it would break down when the demon and the system reached the same temperature, but that could actually be a very, very long time. And, you know, it might be actually on time scales of the age of the Earth, right? You know, so if I say, you know, I'm going to use some temperature source to heat these balls and keep them flying around, and I'm going to sort them, it's not at all obvious that I ever come to the same temperature as that, because I can walk away and come back and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is a non-equilibrium situation, right? So we've got them at two different temperatures. We're not in equilibrium, not at the same temperature. We can't say that the entropy drop of the system is compensated by the increase in entropy of the daemon. It's not that he has to burn a certain amount of energy for every process that he's doing that's equal to the amount he gains from that process at the time. Okay, it's only true when you're in equilibrium. So how do we resolve this then? Basically, if we go back, the entropy of the whole system, now I'm thinking of the daemon and the gas together, was already low at the beginning. So remember how I defined the entropy in terms of equivalent states. So if I just look at the gas, I would say at the beginning I had the gas, which was in this distributed thing, and at the end I had it all sorted over into this one. So if I look at just the gas by itself, I would say entropy decreased. Okay, but if I remember the daemon is in the system, the daemon is part of the box, okay, the systems that the states that the daemon is selecting are not macroscopically equivalent. They can't be included in the same entropy sum that I would do if the daemon wasn't there, right? Because the daemon is making them non-macroscopically equivalent by selecting them and by saying, I'll do this if this happens and I'll do something else if I see a different thing. So it's selecting them, it's making them non-macroscopically equivalent. So one way to put that is to say that the entropy is already low at the beginning because these states are not macroscopically equivalent from the beginning as soon as the daemon is there. They have different macroscopic implications. So what do we conclude from that? Well, where did the low entropy come from? Well, it's not in the gas. The gas is the same whether the daemon's there or not, so clearly it has to be in the daemon. All right. So the daemon, basically what we can say is an information processing system is intrinsically a low entropy system. High information is thermodynamically unlikely to the same degree as a spontaneous reduction in entropy of the amount subtracted by the daemon. Okay, so this connects us now to some of these probability arguments. I kind of don't like defining information in terms of probability because it sort of begs the question, but you can do it another way and say, well, if I have an information processing system, what's the likelihood of that occurring spontaneously? And basically for an information, so if I was just to walk through nature, say I'm on the moon, and I say, what's the odds that a thing that's going to sort the rocks is going to appear on the moon just spontaneously? You could see that that would be thermodynamically extremely unlikely because it would require a huge reduction in entropy in order to get the thing to exist and spontaneously sort. So I think that's my last slide. So again, just wanted to sort of give you some physical concepts that probably, you know, one of the takeaways is just that, you know, information is a real physical thing and it can be traded for energy and all kinds of things. So I'll stop with that.
This has been ID the Future with Dr. David Snoke. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.